wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Back on the schedule. I looked at the schedule all year, next year.
Hey, folks, we are live on the air here. I'm Andy Griffin. Dr. David Blodgett is with me, and you're like, wait a minute, he comes on Wednesdays, not Thursday. Well, we had to do a little switcheroo this week with Dr. Blodgett's schedule and the mayor's schedule. And anyway, he's here. He's wearing a suit and everything. He looks really good. Makes me look bad in my polo shirt. But thanks for coming, Doc.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That's great to be here.
I appreciate you being here. And there was one other thing I was going to start. I was going through a list of things that we were going to talk about today. I got an ad for something called a Buzz Pack. Do you know what that is? I looked it up. I'm like, is this even legal? What is a Buzz Pack? And according to my search, let's see. Buzz Packs are federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Farm Bill established the legality of hemp and hemp-derived products that contain 0.3% or less Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol on a dry weight basis. I don't know anything about it. I just saw that. I'm like, wait a minute. You can't have, you know, marijuana in Utah, but apparently that's legal?
I don't know. Less than 0.3%, it's legal, but... Yeah.
I know you have your feelings about that particular drug. Because a lot of people in this country, based on especially a lot of states passing recreational marijuana, think, well, marijuana's harmless, but you disagree.
Yeah, it's not harmless. And you know, we, unfortunately, when you say, well, we're going to make it legal, then a lot of people's minds, that makes it fine to do.
It does, yeah.
And the consequences of that will reap for a very long time, and people will deal with that. You know, it's very clear, for example, that you block your REM sleep when you use marijuana. So,
wow.
So the rates of schizophrenia and other mental health disorders associated with marijuana are really dramatically higher, at least double for schizophrenia. And probably largely related to that ability not to get good, solid sleep like we've talked about. And even just that one component, aside from everything else, is a major problem. So THC is the active component in marijuana.
That's tetrahydrocannabinol.
Right.
Yeah, THC.
Right. But then there's subunits of THC. And so you can... I mean, it's convoluted. You can get the subunits, and then they don't call that the full marijuana, and so you can order those on the internet. I mean, it's all available now, and really, it's going to come down to decision making. One of the other health officers in the state has taken to using a term that I kind of think is actually accurate now. It's going to be survival of the informed.
Wow.
And,
okay.
And making sure that you actually don't necessarily listen to whatever somebody on Facebook's telling you, but somebody that actually knows what they're talking about. And so there's just a lot of, you can find any information you want to support any lifestyle choice you want to make at this point. And in this case, marijuana's just not good. So
what about I have relatives who use the cannabis oil or ointment for, maybe say you have a sore ankle or you have a sore shoulder or something like that. Is that dangerous?
Well, that's most likely CBD, which is
right.
A component of
okay.
That comes from hemp and is different than the psychoactive component. And there's a lot of health claims made. Not a lot of real data to support any of it, but I think it fits into a different category altogether. If you want to
okay.
See if that helps you, things like that, it's a different game than an active psychoactive kind of component like THC is. So
we, back when, you know, we were closing schools and not letting people go to church and stuff 5 years ago with COVID-19. We talked about mental effects of that and maybe long-term effects of that. We've talked about smartphones and long-term effects of that. What about the long-term effects of the legalization of marijuana in, right now, I think it's 23 out of the 50 states have legalized recreational marijuana. In Utah, it's not, but medical marijuana is legalized in Utah. So is there going to be long-term? Well, dumb question. Yes, there is. What are do you think are going to be the long-term effects of us saying, hey, it's okay now, a lot of people?
It's one of those things, like, so cigarette smoking is, you know, the number one killer in America today because it impacts virtually every organ system in the body as far as some sort of negative effect. And so you actually find that that marijuana smoke fits into that same category. It has an impact on almost everything physically. But then you add a mental psychological component onto that with marijuana, and it becomes really difficult to gauge just how big an impact it's going to be, but it's going to be really significant, right? So there's this correlation between the number of joints you smoke in your lifetime and the probability that you will actually go on to college, that you'll be an independent entity able to work for a living as opposed to just being on welfare. And it's you know, we call it a dose response curve in the medical world, but the more times you've smoked marijuana, to where you get up to about 1,000 joints, and your chance of ever graduating from high school, from college, or even high school, and to have a job and not be on welfare is about zero, right? Wow. So we're not talking about minor things. What does it mean to have a whole part of the population that never amount to anything because they only want to be engaged in that activity? So I don't know how to gauge the full breadth of that, but it's tragic, right? And
yeah.
So we get all excited about small numbers of this. This could be, you know, a significant portion of the population that that never shows up to life. So it's hard to imagine.
The you know, there's always going to be the person that's, well, I know somebody who smoked marijuana and they're just fine, or they're successful, or whatever. There's always going to be the anomalies, the exceptions. But you, as a public health official, you deal in the big numbers,
right,
the big picture. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that, especially you read on, you know, Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you read, hey, you know, so-and-so did this and they got through it and everything's just fine. The anecdotal evidence, I think a lot of people buy into.
Well, so 2 points to that. One, we all want to believe we're the exception when,
yeah, that's
when
true,
the numbers say you're not.
Right.
Two, people want to paint it that way, but they're painting the story the way they want it to be and not what reality actually is if you were actually part of, you know, a closer view into them. And so it's really easy to tailor the message in a way that tells the story you want to tell if you're trying to sell a product, right? But just like any other product that people make a ton of money on, you've got to consider where's the money and who's making money here and why would that be important to what they're saying. And this is not about some freedom effort. This is about making people very, very rich, victimizing kids, and it's really disgusting.
As I was looking into it, and I recently had an MRI, my back was not looking very good, and as I was looking into optional treatments besides another surgery, which I do not want, there were so many different voices out there of who to pick and what to do, and I thought to myself, you know, most of these people don't understand that an injury like this is, to them, it's okay. How can I make money off of them picking me? And to me, it's like everyday life. Am I going to have back pain? Am I going to be able to lift whatever I need to lift? Am I going to be able to sleep at night? And that's kind of when I got exposed to exactly what you're talking about. There's so many messages out there, and their message is, I can fix you. But in my mind, their message is, I want your money.
Right.
And so I tried to be really discerning as I decided my treatment course, but it's tough because they don't care. A lot of them out there don't care what, you know, about your personal life. All they care about is getting your credit card number.
Exactly. And whatever claims they can make that'll get you into that realm. So sometimes are they able to deliver, right? Is there science behind what they do? Yeah. I mean, sometimes, but in this case, the marijuana route is not. And,
yeah.
And it's a It's interesting how it's because information, we create more information every year than existed in the entirety of humankind before that. And there, the ability to manipulate and skew and doctor and make things look different than they are has never been greater. It's the strength of the internet is good information. The weakness of the internet is the ability to obscure and mislead, and that information never dies, right? So even if it's bad information, it just perpetuates itself forever, and it's really, really. So we're back to that phrase. It's going to be the survival of the best informed or the well informed, and
that's why I'm glad you're here, because you're informing us.
Trying to sort through this mountain of information is really one of the most difficult tasks of modern life, I think.
Here's an example for you. Today on The Wire, I'm going to read the story straight from The Wire, and then I'll get your reaction on what it might mean. Okay, this is the headline is, "Those working non-traditional hours have increased kidney stone risk." That's the headline. The story is, "Those working the night shift or non-traditional hours are at a greater risk of getting kidney stones." That's according to new research published in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings. Researchers say anyone working a shift outside a 9-to-5 job has a 15% increased risk of getting kidney stones. That number jumps to 22% for people working the night shift. The study involved data from more than 220,000 people in the UK. Hmm. Now, you and I both took statistics in college, and you have kind of made big part of your life as a public health official is studying these statistics. But as I looked at that story, I'm like, okay, well, that's cool. And probably true, right? I mean, this is a pretty big sample size, 220,000 people. But, you know, why? Where does this come from? Maybe they're more likely to drink Gatorade. Yeah. I don't know.
So you always have to wonder what are the factors that predispose towards that, and what makes you more likely to have kidney stones, and why would that be impacted by that, or is there some sort of physiological reason, right? So we do know that shift work and graveyard shift and all that night work, it definitely takes a toll on your sleep.
Yeah.
And the World Health Organization actually in 2007 declared shift work as a probable carcinogen, interestingly enough. And so I have no doubt that the impact on sleep and the ability to get good quality sleep is real, and it creates a whole ton of health issues. So does that factor into this? It definitely could be. I mean,
it's not mentioned in the study, and yet you and I are like, well, what about sleep?
It could be. And so that's always the statistical question is, well, what kinds of things can be contributing to that might not necessarily be part of the analysis, that might change your perception of what they're really saying there. And so if this is just one more piece of data that says, you know, we're hurting people with shift work, maybe, you know, but do we ever have the discussion, well, we should get rid of shift work because it's hard on people? No. Yeah. But I think it's something for people to consider in their choices in life.
So many factors in this story. One of them, I mean, they studied more than 220,000 people, but there are 220,000 people in the UK. Okay, first of all, are British people more predisposed to this happening? We don't know that. What part of the country did they do that study in? You know, was this only in Wales? Was this only in, you know, Scotland? We don't know. And like I said, there's so many factors. And if you took a simple statistics class, you would hopefully look at that with skepticism a little bit.
So there's liars, there's really bad liars, and then there's statisticians, right? And so
and lawyers beyond that. But anyway.
And you can debate endlessly the logistics of studies, and that's why you kind of look for consensus coming out of lots of studies. But it's always a limitation of the scientific method is often the answer you get depends on the question you ask, right? How you ask it. And so I think let me phrase this a different way. They do this study every year out of the Pew Institute where they ask, well, what entities are the most respected in society? And very bottom of the list,
lawyers.
Congress.
Oh, right? Congressmen. Well, most of them are lawyers anyway.
Actually, the very bottom of the list is broadcast media.
Of course.
And the second to the bottom is Congress, right? Yeah. So top of the list is interesting. Small business. The Army.
Really?
Yeah. Police officers are third, but fourth on the list is science, believe it or not. And so, so I don't think, you know, everybody lobs this around. Nobody believes in science. You know, the problem is nobody believes that your interpretation of science is good, right? So we're in a situation where people can see that science is being manipulated by the people that are promoting it and things like that. And so we tend to carve out what we think science is saying and create our own brand of what science is. And that's not right. That's not the scientific process, right? Yeah. And so it's a false version of science where we try and second our other belief systems, maybe political, if I may go there, rather than say, you know, what would a truly unbiased scientific opinion be here? And so I think people understand that we benefit tremendously in modern society from what science has brought to us. That's what I think people are saying, is science is good. But I think what they're recognizing and what we're recognizing is the interpretation of science and what that really means in our life is where the negotiation starts and has become really problematic, right?
So. If somebody makes a point and then follows that up with just follow the science, right. You know, okay, they just interpreted that to back up their argument.
Almost always it's them trying to make their point, whatever it may be, political often, using some sort of twist on something that probably has no bearing in reality. So that, I think, is the real peril of where science is today, is everybody wants to cloak themselves in science, and yet it's clearly advancing an agenda, and that, I think, is what people reject. So that we're back to that topic of how do you cut through the noise and get to real good sources, and that's what hopefully we spend some time doing, you know. So.
Yeah, yeah. And work a little harder at getting to the bottom of it, because it's really easy to get an opinion, especially an opinion you agree with. You can just go out there and find it. But to work hard to get to the actual truth is pretty hard. Yeah. I go back to what my lawyer friend always said. Well, you know, truth is relative. I'm like, that doesn't sound right to me. Truth isn't real. He's like, oh, it depends on how you look at it. I'm like, okay, but I always thought truth was truth.
I think the truth is the fixed part. It's the what does that mean that's the relative part. And I think acknowledging that in your life is a step towards greater understanding.
got a commercial in about 4 minutes, but I wanted to ask you on your take on what happened with the director of health in the country saying acetaminophen, Tylenol, basically is seemingly one of the big causes for autism. What do you think about that?
You know, I've tried to research this and cut through all of the rhetoric. There have been several fairly large observational studies that have made that link out of reputable places like Stanford and Harvard and things like that. There's always this caution that they're not 100% sure what that means, right? But interestingly, the political lines have lined up on this, right? So there's nothing that can't be controversial in our country.
I'm going to cure cancer. No, you can't do that. Yeah.
So we have this acknowledgement that there are now studies that have made that link. There are studies that haven't made that link. And so I think it's still a tentative kind of thing. It's a warning flag, but it's not a definite warning flag. One of the real problems we have is if you have a high fever in pregnancy, you got to have something, right?
Yeah.
And the harms of high fever to a baby are definite, right? And so for a long time now, you know, Tylenol's been the only avenue that we've had to do that. And
right.
Ibuprofen has got other side effects and black box warnings during pregnancy. And so we've really been left with Tylenol. And so you need a pretty firm, dramatic link before you throw everything out and just say, well, just suffer with the fever, because that probably would have more of an impact than say what the Tylenol might be. So I don't know. It's left, I think, in the realm of talk it through with your doctor and see what he says kind of stuff, instead of, a definite, just you can pop all the Tylenol you want. Now, almost always when you look at the studies, it's pretty high dose Tylenol, right? Over a long time. And so I think I'm settling to the place where I would say, if you have a, you get sick and you have a fever and you're worried about high fever, I would use the Tylenol in that situation rather than let that fever run its course. So,
okay. It's a tough deal. I have a condition with my stomach where I can't take NSAIDs. So I take my drug of choice is acetaminophen, is Tylenol. If I get a headache, if I have muscle aches, whatever, I pop one. And I have to admit, when after this came out last week, when I went to grab my jar of Tylenol, I'm like, maybe I shouldn't. Yeah. And whether that, I mean, I'm not pregnant. I'm not going to have an autistic child, but it gave me pause at least a little bit to think about it. And I don't know if that's what was intended or not. But
well, I think part of the problem in all this discussion is any substance can have a negative effect at a high enough dose or low, you know, just depend. It's just trying to identify what are the most problematic and
right.
So
the trade-off,
every substance has what we, it's called the LD50, the dose, the lethal dose at which 50% will die from that substance.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
So water has an LD50,
right?
It's like 8 or 10 gallons of water. If you drink it all at the same time, you know, that's enough to kill you. So I think basically what will happen is the recommendations around using Tylenol in pregnancy will become more nuanced than just that's your go-to, right?
Okay.
I think they'll say, and it's nuanced anyways, because too much Tylenol causes liver damage, right? I mean, it's not like you just want to take unlimited amounts of Tylenol anyway. And so I think we'll get to a place where it's a little more nuanced than it has been. But I think that will still be our really only available tool to help with fever in pregnancy, which is important. So,
all right, 9:30 on KDXU. Let's do a check of weather and a commercial break. We'll be back with more with Dr. Blodgett, our public health official here for Southern Utah, right after this.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
We're talking with Dr. Blodgett today. He's one of the smartest guys I know, so that's why I have him on the show.
Now you're kind.
For years, I've been saying this, Dr. Blodgett. I don't know a lot about a lot of stuff. I know a lot about a lot of stuff, but I don't know a lot about stuff. And so I bring people on like you who do know a lot about stuff to kind of set me on the right.
Yeah, you're kind, and you're underestimating yourself. And you know a lot about a lot.
Well, unfortunately, my areas of expertise are sports and music, and that's not going to get me a lot of money down the road. But hey, let's talk measles for a second. 44 cases in the state of Utah, and from what I'm reading, 30 of the 44 involve, well, they're in your district, right? They're in southern Utah. Is that
right,
true?
They're here in our area. Yeah, we're seeing the impact of lower vaccination rates, and I think we'll continue to see it. So
it's going
to
get worse. This is a disease 25 years ago that we had declared was done. It was eradicated.
Eradicated from the United States. Now it's back, and we're seeing regular cases of it. 5 hospitalizations in there.
Wow.
Some, Life Flight on one case.
Oh, my
trips
goodness.
In the ambulance. You know, really expensive care to treat. So, you know, we're just sitting there, and you know, the fatality rate's 1 in 1,000, but we do have that, gosh, in kids under 5, it's a 20% hospitalization rate.
Wow.
About 10 to 12% overall for the entire population for getting hospitalized. So you know, fever, rash, conjunctivitis, you know, pink eye kind of stuff, aches, pains, dehydration, pneumonia, all of it fits into that constellation of measles here. So if you have symptoms consistent with that, you know, watch for it. We consistently put out these warnings that you really can't stop measles because it's so easily spread. You're spreading it for 4 days before you really know you have measles.
Would you say measles is the most infectious disease out there, the easiest to spread?
It's pretty close.
It's the most infectious that I know of a specific R-naught about. So I think it probably is. It's, you know, the R-naught for COVID was right around 2, right? That's how many people each infected person would infect. Mm-hmm. Measles, the R-naught is 19. So every infected person will infect 19 people around them if they're not vaccinated, right? So the vaccine, incredibly effective. You know, 97, 98, 99% with 2 doses. And so if you're vaccinated, you just don't have to worry about it. But if you're not vaccinated, then that's a concern. And there are those few, there's some that it just doesn't work, right? And so then you've got that worry that if they're immune compromised or, you know, and babies under 1 year old, they really can't get vaccinated yet. And so that's the group that I think we're going to see some deaths in. To be honest with you, going forward, we've had 3 in the outbreak that we had in Texas. 3 babies died there, and so, yeah. So it just doesn't seem necessary. But you know, we're in a world where people make choices, and that's okay. I just have this responsibility to make sure people understand what that means.
So. I actually heard someone say, Dr. Blodgett, "Oh, it's just measles. What's the big deal? I don't need to worry about it."
Yeah,
is that anywhere close to being accurate?
Well, I guess it depends on what your definition of just measles is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If high fever, being sick, having to go to the ER and be in the hospital for a night or two is okay, then you know, then that's just measles.
That's not okay.
But it is for that 1 in 1,000 that's a fatality, and if that's okay, that's okay too. I'm just... You got to realize, and we always talk about this, but it might be just measles for you, but it's not just measles for somebody else, mm-hmm. right? And so if they're immune compromised, and it's always that part of the equation that I don't know how to help, right? If you're immune compromised and you would get vaccinated or you have been vaccinated, it just doesn't work for you because your immune status is down. All the rest of us getting vaccinated protects them, right? That's what herd immunity is all about. But they're not protected if we have a significant portion of the population unvaccinated. And so then they live this life of worry, right? Am I going to get measles and die, right? It's an unkind thing.
So. With the infectious rate so high with that.
Right.
Not only am I going to get measles and it may kill me, but... Do I dare even go out in public?
Right.
Because if one person in this crowd of 40 people has it, I'm probably going to get it.
Exactly. And it can it just hangs in the air, right? So it's a true airborne disease. So the current recommendation is that it can hang there for 2 hours after somebody leaves a room. So
Wow. You
don't even know anybody's in there. You walk in and it's there in the air. Very small number of particles, you know, can give you an infection. So it's just kind of this perfect disease for spreading. And you know, fortunately, historically, it's been fairly low mortality, but 1 in 1,000, that's about the rate of overall mortality that COVID had. So we're not, you know, it's not a minor disease in the constellation of diseases. It's just where we're at with that. So we're also seeing a huge uptick in the number of pertussis cases. So we haven't even hit cold and flu season yet, but we're already twice the number of cases of pertussis reported to us this year that we had last year. So pertussis is really back. And pertussis is an ugly disease too, right? They call it pertussis for a reason, around vomiting. So you cough hard enough that you vomit. The 100-day cough is the other term for it. And so you end up, it's a long, if you have cough that just hangs and hangs and hangs forever, you know, it could be pertussis. And then it's also called whooping cough because you cough so long and so hard that you, when you get a chance to finally inhale some air, you do this big dramatic in-breath.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a whoop, you know, so it's a whooping cough. And so, kind of, interesting times when we're seeing diseases come back that just shouldn't be here,
right? Yeah,
because we have a very effective tool to get rid of them. So.
Okay, let's answer a couple of texts. Could you ask the doctor regarding sleep? While I do get 8 hours of sleep a night, it's generally interrupted. I have a dog that constantly goes in and out each night, and I have to let her in and out. What kind of effects does this have on my health? I know sleep is very important, but how does this affect my health when it's interrupted like that?
Yeah. So there's two questions surrounding that, right? Mm-hmm. One is when you wake up, it kind of interrupts that flow into deeper stages of sleep and in and out of REM and stuff like that. But then there's also the how well do you go back to sleep problem, right? And so a lot of people will wake up, the dog wakes them up or something, and then they just can't go back to sleep too. So I think both are a problem. It's less of a problem if you wake up and then go right back to sleep, but it's still a problem. And, and so the recommendation for that is, well, you know, making sure you get 8 hours of time in bed is good, because then you probably get about 7 hours of real sleep. If it wakes you up and you don't go back to sleep, then there's some tricks to try and help with that. But that's really where a lot of people really suffer, because then it's that last half of the night when most of the REM sleep happens, which is when you consolidate memories, when you make sense of mood and all that stuff. And REM's pretty aggressive. If you don't get enough REM, then it starts to invade other places. So you get daytime errors and, you know, things like that. So the answer is whatever you can do to help decrease the interruptions of sleep and waking up is important. So maybe, I don't know, a doggy door, let the dog go out or something. Yeah. They actually, most of the sleep manuals will say don't let your dog sleep with you, because that's a good way to not get good sleep. And I don't know if your dogs are like ours, but they tend to own the bed by the end of the night, and you're hanging off the end of the bed somewhere, you know. And so so keep the dog out of the room is a good suggestion. A lot of men suffer with, you know, got to go to the bathroom multiple times a night, and seeing if you can't talk to your doctor about that, so that's not a factor in your life.
There is some medication that can help with that,
right? And it's good to know. Maybe you have something else going on too, right? We men tend to not want to know until it's too late to know.
Yeah,
and,
don't tell me.
That's not a that's a symptom of something might be going on, or it's just part of aging. But
and the other thing I think it's worth bringing up again is that medicating yourself so you can sleep, taking sleeping pills or whatever. Say it again, like you said a few months ago. That is not, it's not real sleep.
You're not sleep, getting better sleep. You're sedating yourself, right? And so when you look at the architecture of people on sleeping pills, their sleep architecture, it's not good, deep, restorative sleep. It's just, you think you're sleeping, you feel like you are, but it's not what you really need. And that effect lessens dramatically too. The sedating doesn't even happen, and so you end up just trying to sleep. You're taking these pills, you're thinking that's helping, but it's actually just making the situation worse. So
we got another text. I don't know if you want to comment on this one, because it's kind of a loaded question. Ask Dr. Blodgett about Balance of Nature and the thoughts of using them. And you know, it's one of those deals that I guess the jury's still out in a lot of ways. And by the way, the person asking about sleep said they are able to go right back to sleep. So that's good news.
That's good news. Yeah. I'm glad they're in that phase. I really think the part of the problem is sleep becomes more fragile as you age.
It's true.
And so, you know, when you're a kid, you can kind of sleep on anything. I remember I had a friend that we could sit him on top of a piano bench and he'd sleep, you know, for the rest of the night. But the older you get, the more things have to be just right. And you have to really, I think, kind of be very intentional about, making sure that is a priority in your life, and take some extra steps to make sure you have the opportunity to do that. And then there are if you feel like you've got sleep apnea and stuff, even though you do sleep, you feel bad, then it's really important to get in and get that looked at by somebody that can help you navigate through that, because that really defeats your purpose in trying to sleep as well. So it's a complex issue, and I don't think we talk nearly enough about it as a society. So
as far as the balance of nature, I'll ask you about it, but my opinion is, look, if you don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, it's definitely going to help. Will it replace eating fruits and vegetables? I don't believe it will replace it, but I think it will help. Is that about?
Yeah, I don't think there's enough data or studies to make too many comments on. I like the theory, but I think, I don't know if the practice is reality there. I don't know.
Okay. We'll take a break. 9:47 on KDXU. Dr. Blodgett in the house. We'll be right back.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show. on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Thanks for tuning in, Andy Griffin Show with Dr. Blodgett today. A follow-up on the sleeping part of it. So what about melatonin as a sleep aid? Do you have any opinion on melatonin?
Yeah, so and the studies aren't great on melatonin. So melatonin is a natural component of the sleep drive that helps you sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. What you're doing to sabotage your melatonin takes away a lot more melatonin than you can take from a supplement to replace it. Does that make sense? So,
yeah. So, you'd have to take a lot to replace it.
And it's really irritating to the gut and stuff like that. And so the tablets are small. And there's one situation where melatonin in studies has been shown to make a difference. And that's if you are flying and you're crossing time zones. And so that throws off your sleep schedule. A little bit of melatonin in there can help kind of right that balance. But
that's good to know, actually.
But you will return much more melatonin to your system if you, for example, don't use your blue light right before bed. So that blue light, you know,
none of us
suppresses
do that.
Your melatonin. And that's really the enemy here on where. So the idea would be, well, you replace that melatonin that you lose with the blue light, but it doesn't really do a good job of that. And so the idea is just don't have the blue light. But
yeah.
I recognize that I'm going against all of culture right now, and you know nobody wants to hear that. But but it's the evidence is really clear that when you those blue lights, they hit the back of your brain. It goes right to your pituitary, hypothalamus, all those gland-secreting parts of the brain. You end up not secreting nearly as much melatonin, and it really impacts your sleep and your ability to get to sleep. Now, here's the alarming part.
Uh-oh. I thought you just told us the alarming part.
Well, it is, but it's even worse in one way, and that is if you get that blue light issue for an adult, it'll suppress your melatonin for a couple of hours, and then when you finally shut off the screens, it'll come back up after a couple of hours, right? So so it'll delay your sleep, but it'll still allow you to sleep.
Okay.
In kids, the melatonin never comes back up.
Oh, no.
So your kids, it's a whole different game because you suppress their melatonin, and then it never recovers, and so they actually don't have a pathway to get sleep for the rest of the night. And so, so it's even more important in kids to tell them, look, you can't be on your devices into the night. You've got to allow that natural increase of melatonin. Alarmingly enough, the studies are showing that about 80% of kids have taken melatonin at some point in their life, and a lot of them are on that kind of chronically. So I think parents are recognizing there's this need to help their kids sleep, but it's not doing what it's supposed to do, but it is a problem that they're not getting enough sleep. So something like 80%, 70 to 80% of high school seniors on our surveys, when we ask kids how well do you sleep, say they are not getting the 8 hours of recommended sleep. They're far less than that. And so this time when they're supposed to be making good decisions about their life, when they're supposed to be remembering all the things they're learning, you know, all of that, it's really a critical time of life. They're doing it with one hand tied behind their back because they aren't getting enough sleep. So
terrible. Now, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but blue light, is there a way for whoever makes these phones and video games and TVs, is there a way to make them have less blue light, or is blue light here get used to it?
Yeah, so they've tried with like dark mode on your iPhone. You might see people wearing those yellow glasses that kind of screen out some of the blue light, and the studies are it's better than just the raw blue light, but it's not as good as no blue light.
No blue light. So. Is there a recommendation, an hour before bedtime? Is that what kind of the recommendation is right now?
At least an hour. Be even better if you could do two, but at least an hour avoiding, you know. So blue lights, that's TVs.
I was going to say, we're not just talking about the phone either, are we?
It's bright fluorescent lights in your home, you know, and your iPad and iPhone. So unfortunately, the LED bandwidth is geared around that blue light. And And it blue light's not all bad. There's a cycle here, right? You're supposed to get blue light in the day, so it suppresses that melatonin. Cortisol goes up. That's the alertness hormone. It gets you going for the day. But then towards night, it flips, right? The cortisol is supposed to come down. The melatonin is supposed to go up. But if you don't sleep, the cortisol never comes down, which makes it hard to sleep. You don't get enough melatonin because you've got the blue lights on, and you get this chronic sleep problem where it just exacerbates itself and really, really interferes with your quality of life. So.
It really sounds, and your teenagers are not going to like this, but it really sounds like to me having a base station where you plug your phone in the central part of the home, and your kid goes to bed without the phone, maybe goes in and reads for a minute, or I don't know what else they would do. It sounds like a really good idea. I know, like, oh, that's old fashioned, you old geezer, or whatever.
Really, really will bear benefits for you. There's also this study. We have a chance where they took a couple hundred people and they said, all right, we want you to just not have your phone in the bedroom at all.
Okay.
And then they asked, they had a priest survey and a post study, and they said, okay, what does that mean for you? What happened? And they reported, you know, better sleep, higher quality of life, more connection as a couple and closeness of in your relationships.
Yeah.
The whole thing was better. And, you know, 95% of them said, yep, I'm never bringing the phone back into my bedroom. Right.
Wow.
And so, but then they asked them 6 months later whether the phone was in their bedroom.
Oh, no.
And, you know, it was there for most of them. So I think we all know these things, but it's or can we fight the trend of modern society, or are we doomed to be kind of unhealthy and miserable, you know, in some ways? I don't know. But
you have the unenviable job of telling us what's good for us and then having us not listen to you. But would you compare that to getting your enough exercise, getting enough sleep, getting eating right?
Yeah.
Not having as much blue light.
Right.
Is it the same thing,
then? In that realm. In fact, there are studies that show that when you're not sleeping, exercise doesn't help you.
Hmm.
It negates the effect of sleep, of exercise. So sleep, exercise is wonderful, but it has to be on top of the ability to repair. So you're doing damage when you exercise, and the healthy part comes as you repair that. When you don't get that, then you end up just getting the damage, and it doesn't help you.
Mm. My wife is, and it's frustrating to her. She wakes up every morning somewhere between 3 and 5 a.m., and can't go back to sleep. She usually goes in and takes a bath or something like that because she knows that laying there, I mean, that's pretty miserable when you lay there and you can't sleep. Do you have any ideas to combat something like that?
So one thought.
Yeah?
Studies are showing it might be a low blood sugar issue.
Oh.
And so either maybe take a little light snack before you go to bed, or maybe have something there by the bed, just kind of snack on something lightly, you know, not a ton, because that'll cause problems too, but something to bump that blood sugar a little bit, and maybe you go right back to sleep.
Good advice from the good doctor here on the Andy Griffin Show. Dr. Blodgett is with us every month, first Wednesday of every month. I know today's not Wednesday. We had to do some switching, but so grateful that you're here and you're keeping an eye on us down here in southern Utah. Sometimes, I guess, probably pretty thankless job of being the public health official.
It's great to have a good purpose in life, though, you know.
So it is.
Trying to help people be healthy. But thank you, Andy, for all you do.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. We will step aside. There were a couple of things I was going to ask you about, but we've run out of time. One of them, real quick, weighing yourself. Is it healthy to weigh yourself every single day? I do that. I know I have a problem. The one doctor of the story I was reading, he's like, no, try, how about every 2 weeks or something like that? Any thoughts real quick, in 30 seconds?
I'm torn on this because I think it's a better way to try and say, you know what, I'm a pound up, I'm going to do something, as opposed to I'm going to wait for 2 months and then I'm going to try and lose 5 pounds. I don't know. I'm of two minds. I think ultimately what works for you to help and you maintain the weight you need to maintain is important.
Perfect. He's Dr. Blodgett. I'm Andy. Thanks for listening. Be back tomorrow. Open lines. Talk to you then.